I'm very honored to be here because I'd first heard about some of these issues being raised internationally when my friend Thomas Stinberg, who's sitting here, sent me a clipping of Raymond Baker's testimony to a Senate committee. And after that, over the years, I've drawn upon material from Raymond Baker, from Simon Pack, who's here, from John Christensen, in writing about this subject. And today I've had the pleasure of hearing Mr. Blum and Mr. Weiner and Anthea Lawson, all of whom are people I hadn't heard of earlier. So this has been very instructive to me. I should say that my perspective is really very different from many of the other people's, not in terms of any disagreement with them, but because I've been a journalist for most of my working life. So most of it is partly an anecdotal view, partly a very selective view, and may also have some degree of inaccuracy, but it's a different sort of view. I would say that the first thing that strikes me always when I'm outside India is how different is the perception in the international press, and indeed from that matter, indeed for that matter in the Indian press, from the real, the Indian reality, because one always hears about this Indian miracle, the fantastic growth, and the how India and China are two great economic superpowers, and really nothing about the fact that you have a country where more than half the population is below the poverty line, where virtually every communicable disease down to cerebral malaria is available in every Indian city and town, and there is no system of effective vaccination for any major epidemic disease. For the fact that you've got starvation in documented starvation in every state of the Indian Union, such a large number of people who have died, and of farmers who have committed suicide because they are so deeply indebted that they cannot hope to repay their debts. So this is another India, and I'm trying to make a connection between that India and the first India, the India which is such an economic miracle, and whether there are international concerns in terms of these issues of illicit capital movements. And I see two connections which I think are relevant. The first is there have been important policies in the last decade and more of very regressive redistribution. Now, some of these have been overt in the sense of destroying the public distribution system of food availability, the withdrawal of all investment in agriculture for more than a decade, the absence of any significant spending in public health, and the privatization of important sectors of the Indian economy, particularly telecommunications and petroleum, which has also meant a transfer of wealth from public agencies to a few families which have controlled these industries. So this has been one significant change. The part of this change has also been that what has once been seen as theft has been subsequently legalized in terms of amnesties provided by a government fiat in different areas, debt forgiveness on a massive scale from, for example, this company SR, which sold its stake to Vodafone for something, I can't remember, the order of $12 billion, two years ago received a large-scale debt amnesty. So it's a country which, a company which is both the beneficiary of state largesse and phenomenally wealthy, and much of that $12 billion has actually gone to three people. So this is the anomaly. The other part of it, which feeds directly into what we can see as illicit movement, is of course the fact that as much perhaps as Nigeria, but more poorly recorded is the fact that you've had a very large number of corrupt deals. My friend Rear Admiral Purovitz documented in great detail naval procurement from Germany and from Russia and the Ukraine, and showed how there was very systematic mispricing. Particularly, he showed this in respect not of capital purchases, but also actually of the maintenance orders for various warships, which were sometimes inflated 10,000% for individual items like screws. So it's very difficult to track those down. That's the attractive thing about this, because if you have one large warship which you buy and you say you spend $2 billion for it, then it people look more closely at it. But if you steadily inflate the price of every screw and every bit and piece of engineering goods, then it's much more difficult, because it's a very steady drain. This case was, in fact, though Admiral Purovitz was sacked by the Defense Ministry, this case was taken up, in fact, by Transparency International, but I don't think it's actually had any effect, because his litigation from 1999 is still in court. Well, there are numerous other such important privatizations. In fact, about 10 years ago, I studied the petroleum industry, and I saw two different large categories of public expenditure. And in one of them, we quantified that it was about a $1.75 billion of over-invoicing. And a number of such cases, which are actually quite well known within people who have been following this, but haven't really gained very great publicity, but are a feature, an important feature of the Indian corrupt economy. Another well-known case was that of Bofors, which went on for more than a decade, which paid the Swedish arms manufacturer, which paid large bribes in India to people in office. And I knew one of the bankers who handled one of the payments for that, and for Lazard London, for Lazard Channel Islands. And I was disappointed to see that when the villa she owned in Tuscany vaporized 2 years ago with her in it, there was no notice anywhere in the press about this, though everybody talked about it. Similarly, given how large a role Bank of America, the private bank, has played in handling many of these transactions, when I saw their large office, which runs India Private Banking in London, visited this gorgeous mansion and saw one of their clients climbing up the staircase and recognized the Attorney General of India, then I knew this bank was to be taken very seriously as far as anything concerning India went. But really nobody writes very much or takes up these issues seriously. So this is part of this large covert area. Both these have essentially done one important thing, which is to take the money out of the jurisdiction, which is the important issue. I think that Professor Pogge talked about this issue of sovereignty. Well, one thing is to take it out of the jurisdiction so that even if it belongs to a subject of this sovereign, once it moves out, then the issue is more difficult to pursue.